to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. Happy holiday to everybody. Between Christmas and New Year's, kind of that interregnum period, but it never stops for active people like my guests, like myself. And of course, always important topics to talk about on this show. Jack Rasmus is my guest. Jack is a regular on the program. He's got his own PRN program now. Alternative Visions, I think you call it, Jack.
That's correct. Wednesdays.
Well, you have certainly written volumes on the fiscal cliff. I'm sure you've talked about it on your program. I've written volumes on it, too. I started writing about it last year. I think it might have even been in 2010 before the word fiscal cliff existed. But, you know, Simpson Bowles and that kind of stuff, Obama's Deficit Cutting Commission and the scheme that was cooked up, Simpson Bowles, there was another one with Alice Rivlin and... who was the Republican with her? Another organization. I remember writing about that.
Domenici,
yeah. Retired senator. Mm-hmm. And they came up with a similar plan. You know, kill social America. That's what it is. Kill America's social contract. Prioritize war-making. Prioritize corporate handouts, banker bailouts, and the rest of it. It's the same kind of dirty scheme. Fiscal cliff, I mean, they can come up with any language they want, Jack. It's subterfuge hype. It really stands for nothing. The only fiscal cliff, I guess, exists in the mind's eye. There's no urgency to cut the debt or the deficit by the stroke of midnight in just a few days. I mean, that kind of talk is absolute malarkey. It means nothing. But the real agenda is the one that you really need to focus on, and it really is doing everything for corporate America and super-rich elites and making ordinary people pray for their waste, crime, abuse, and excess. That's what it comes to. And for years, I mean, Republicans never wanted the social contract in the first place. Democrats got it under FDR and Lyndon Johnson, and they've been chipping away at it since maybe the mid-1970s, certainly since the 1980s, and especially in the new millennium. And Obama is a chipper, just the way George Bush was, and they're hammering at it. I think the basic deal is cut, Jack, and they're just working out the fine print. And I think you've written in your articles that we're not going to get a grand bargain by the stroke of midnight. We'll get it in stages. We'll get a little bit to kick us over, so that they can say they accomplished something, and they won't turn into pumpkins come January 1, and then they'll keep talking about it in Q1. They'll probably kick it into Q2, and before the year is over. I shudder to think of the horrors that are going to pass, including juicy corporate tax cuts. You explain it. You explain it best.
Yeah, well, that's been my analysis for several months now. During the election, when they were talking about the false economic program, telling people what they wanted to hear, the lieutenants of both parties were beginning to hammer out the real program, which is this, quote, fiscal cliff. You can go to my blog site and website. My blog site is jackrasmus.com. And I've been writing almost an article a week on my blog, jackrasmus.com, predicting that there would be a deal since right after the election, my prediction, because you've got the big corporate CEOs, Fortune 500, aligned with Obama right now. And they're putting pressure on the Republican radicals, the Tea Partiers and so forth, who are resisting and who are trying to blow up the deal, but are losing, very clearly losing ground, and they are boxed in right now. So there's a big deal coming. But see, the corporate CEOs have to get some kind of a fiscal cliff deal done before Obama can deliver what he promised them for the past year and during the election even, to cut top corporate tax rates from 35% to 28%. That's coming. But as I've been predicting, there will be three stages. This first stage will be a nominal sort of agreement on whatever they can, just to keep the ball rolling. And it may come on the 31st, it may come on the 2nd or 3rd, but something will happen extending the negotiations. And then the meat of it will occur before March, because you really don't have the government running out of money until March. You don't really have a true debt ceiling until March. And then they will, in a second phase, an early part of this coming year, will agree to cut more. But then the big cuts, or the big deal, will come with a major revision of the tax code. in the second half of 2013. And that's where the big corporate tax cut of 35 to 28% will come. And probably that's when they'll really go after raising the age for Social Security, Medicare, and so forth, take a big bite out of all that, and Medicaid, et cetera. So it will be three stages. I've been predicting that for several months. But there will be a deal. And if people are interested in this whole history of the deficit cutting, which you referred to, you can go to my website where I have a free Chapter 7 of my book this year. My book this year was Obama's Economy, Recovery for the Few. And Chapter 7 was all about the deficit cutting from the very beginning, from 2009, when they were passing this stimulus bill. They were already preparing to take it back with deficit cutting once the recovery was actually occurred. Of course, it hasn't occurred, at least not for the rest of us. It's certainly occurred for stock markets and bond markets and so forth, well up over 100% in the last couple of years, while the median family income has dropped 10%. So everyone else is going backwards, but you know, speculators, investors, they're doing quite well, and now the corporate CEOs want their big cut. Corporate profits up over 100% as well, and bonuses for CEOs and bankers and so forth, all up. The rest of us, no, we still have 20 million people unemployed. This so-called recovery in the housing sector is a joke, in general, things haven't improved for the rest of us. That's what I had predicted in my 2010 book, Epic Recession, that we would bounce along the bottom with a lot of false positive recoveries, and this could go on for a long time, just as it's gone on for Japan. This concept, fiscal cliff, is really what I call austerity American style. Trying to coin that term, because that's really what it is. No matter what the deal is, it's going to amount to a further retraction of the stimulus in one form or another. And the stimulus, of course, in 2009-10 was insufficient and improperly focused on tax cuts, especially for investors and corporations. But you know, the fiscal stimulus is being retracted with fiscal cliff, a.k.a. American austerity style, no matter what the outcome is. Fiscal cliff, by the way, was a term invented or proposed by Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, the central bank, because Bernanke has been pumping so much money into the economy, he didn't want to rely totally on monetary policy. By the way, which is the other major policy crisis, not just fiscal crisis here at fiscal cliff, but monetary policy is in crisis globally. All the central banks, to historic dimensions, are pumping trillions of dollars into the economy. Why? To keep the stock and bond markets going, that's why. Because we really have a big bond bubble that's brewing. We can talk about that in the future. That will be a repeat, I predict, of the subprime mortgage crisis, which, of course, was a bond crisis. You know, you take the subprime mortgages, you put them into mortgage bonds, and that's what precipitated everything. It wasn't initially a stock crisis. It was a bond crisis. And we got another big one brewing, I believe, in the junk bond market and so forth. So, but that's going to take a little while to ripen, except all over the world now, we have this huge injection of liquidity, printing money, pumping it into the economy. ECB, European Central Bank, has been doing it to some extent. Bank of England has been doing it. Now, big crisis brewing in Japan, and Japan's going to follow Bernanke's lead here. And we got all the major central banks of the world pumping trillions of dollars to hold up the investors. At the same time, their politicians are working on making people pay for this. So that's China, what fiscal cliff really is.
China also printing money.
Yeah, I haven't been following China. I don't know. But, you know, all the printing money has the following result. It drives down the value of their respective currencies. And what we got is a renewal of the currency wars going on. And this time it's who can drive down the price of their currency exchange rate, in other words, faster than someone else, because if you can do that, you can get a bigger chunk of the world export trade pie for your particular economy. Of course, that's a zero-sum game. Everybody can play that, and they're all playing that now. They're all driving down, trying to drive down their currency, and we go from one currency to the other being the leading lowest cost currency, and that creates a nice environment for foreign exchange speculators. You know, when you have a lot of volatility in exchange rates, and of course hedge funds and all these speculators make a lot of money doing that. So that's what's going on. A new currency war is brewing. It started in 2010 and was tamed a little bit. Then it was achieved by respective countries driving down the wages and therefore the costs of the products, of their own labor force. But now it's taking a new form. Now it's taking exchange rate form, and that's an indicator of depression-like conditions. That's what happened in the 30s, and one of the reasons why the depression in the 30s went on so long, respective countries attempted to manipulate their exchange rates by formally declaring devaluations. Well, they don't formally declare devaluations now. They do it with monetary policy. But monetary policy is not working to stimulate the economy. It's all about giving more profit opportunities to stock and bond and currency and derivative speculators. That's what it's all about.
Well, Jack, there's been an awful lot, just in America, there's been an awful lot of Q1, Q2, Q3, Q4, Operation Twist, and it really has done virtually little, let me say little, to do anything about stimulating growth. I mean, it's all about pumping money, benefiting bankers, benefiting speculators, but it does not stimulate growth. And you've made the point over and over again that taxes, whether they go up or down, have little effect on economic activity. I mean, economic activity is really the situation of using a nation's resources productively to stimulate growth. You don't do it by cutting taxes. You use it by making productive investments. I mean, we've done it in America before, Jack. It's been done around the world before. But it certainly is not being done now the way it was done before. And we could solve this economic problem very easily if we just followed responsible economics instead of bailout economics and money printing economics that benefits the 1% and the 99% take it in the air.
Well, you know, the 1% have control of the political system, and their strategy, I'm firmly convinced, is, just keep our profits going, and let's wait, and the system will recover on its own. Let's not do anything drastic like cutting our big tax cuts, limiting our big tax cuts. Let's tough it out, because we're not in such a tough shape, We're fully recovered in 1 year. Let's just let the rest of the country tough it out for 3 or 4 more years, and we'll recover, and everything will be fine, and you won't have to touch our tax cuts and all our subsidies and so forth. And that's their strategy, just to tough it out. You can see that's going on in Europe. You can see it's going on here. Tough it, of course, for the rest of us. But this whole history of deficit cutting is in an article from Chapter 7 of my book on my website, which is Kyklos Productions, kyklosproductions.com. You can Google me, and you'll see Kyklos Productions. And go, I tell your listeners, go read that free chapter from my book called Deficit Cutting on the Way to Double Dip Recession, which covers the whole history of deficit cutting from 2010 through the present. Well, through last year, and then go to my blog for all the updates on deficit cutting. But it's the fundamental strategy of let's pump all the money in the world that we can print quickly to support our stock, bond, and derivative markets for the rest of us investors to recover, and then let's tough it out and austerity for the rest of the folks, and tough it through and wait for the recovery. Of course, there is no automatic recovery. That's a false economic idea that goes way back a couple hundred years, that the system won't recover on its own. And we will recover like Japan has recovered the last 20 years, right? What a recovery. Virtually no growth for 20 years. But that's what an epic recession is, where you bounce along the bottom recovery and you don't really fundamentally recover. And every time you get a financial banking crash, it goes down further. And that's what we're stuck in. And we're going to see virtually very little growth. We're bouncing along the bottom. It's not a double dip. But it could slip into a double dip very easily this coming year with a crisis, further crisis in the European banking system, which will drive those economies already in recession even further, deeper in recession. And now we've got Japan beginning to look like a crisis point as well.
Well, they've got a new prime minister in Japan. I remember many years ago when Milton Friedman was alive, the guru of monetary policy, and Japan back in the 1990s, he urged them to print money. And I think they basically followed his advice, Jack. But as you say, their stock market peaked on the last trading day of 1989. It was a little bit under 40,000, 39,000 up in the 800 or 900s, something like that. I don't know what it is exactly today. It may be 9 or 10,000, something like that. But 20-odd years later, 22 years later, and Japan is still fighting to get out of the fiscal monetary crisis. I mean, they could keep this thing going for another two decades, and the same thing could happen to America and Europe.
Well, see, what happened in Japan was they refused to stimulate the economy fiscally, and they tightened up fiscally, like we're doing and Europe is doing, and they pumped all this money into the banking system. And what did the banks do? The banks loaned that, borrowed from their central bank at virtually no interest once again, and loaned to Japanese business and speculators who did what? Invested abroad. Okay, and not in their own country. And that's exactly what's happening now. We pump all this money into the banking system. The bank gives low-interest loans to speculators, hedge funds and equities and private equity firms and so forth. And what do? They go and invest offshore in emerging markets, exchange-traded funds, foreign exchange funds and so forth, CDSs, credit default swaps on Greek bonds, and make that situation worse. So they're getting free money, and they're making profits hand over fist with free money. And actually, the Federal Reserve is paying banks, U.S. banks, to take free money. It's not a quarter of a percent interest. If you're a bank, you can borrow from the Fed. You can leave your money with the Fed after you borrow, and the Fed will pay you interest. So, in effect, the Fed is paying you to take free money. You can imagine what kind of recovery we would have if the typical median family was able to borrow free money and, buy a house or refinance their house or buy a new car or pay for their education to their kids, with free money. Well, we think you'd have a recovery in 3 months.
Okay. Boy, 3 months, we'll probably have a recovery in 3 weeks.
Yeah. But, that free money is only for banks. We need to totally restructure the banking system in this country. And in my book, the last chapter is called An Alternative Program. And on my radio show, we talk about alternative programs. That's why it's called Alternative Visions on Wednesdays. There's 13 proposals on how to revitalize and restructure the banking system. And I've talked about that in relationship to the fiscal cliff as well. In fact, I have a piece coming out just today. You can go to the Talking Union blog. And I describe how one tax would solve the fiscal cliff. One single tax measure would raise $450 billion a year. What's that measure? Well, you simply raise the effective tax rate, not the nominal tax rate, on the 1%, not even the 2%, the 1%. Back in 1980, the nominal reported tax rate on the wealthiest was 70%. But their actual, what they really paid, was only 45%, the effective rate, we call that, 45%. Well, today, the nominal is 35%, but their effective payment is 22%. Okay? If you simply raise the effective tax rate from today's 22% on the wealthiest to the same effective tax rate in 1980, 45%, you would raise $450 billion a year. That's $4.5 trillion over 10 years, which is exactly what the Simpson-Bowles Commission and everyone else that's playing this game say is the target, $4 trillion. You could raise the $4 trillion with one tax measure. That simple. You know, and you wouldn't have to cut any Social Security, Medicare. You wouldn't have to cut any of the tax cuts for the 98%. You know, you wouldn't even have to cut defense with one tax measure. I mean, it's now that's not even my calculations. That's based upon estimations by professors Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty, University of California, and Professor Piketty's from the French University, École Supérieure, I think it is. Anyway, they've come up with this analysis of what the tax revenue situation is. In 2000, federal taxes as a percent of GDP was 20.6%. 20%, okay, of GDP was tax revenue from all tax sources collected by the federal government. Today it's 14.4%. We've cut it 6 percentage points, 6% of a $16 trillion GDP is $1 trillion. We have cut taxes since 2000 equivalent to $1 trillion a year, every year, as a result of the Bush tax cuts, as a result of the failed recovery of the economy, which means less tax revenue, under Obama. The problem is a tax problem. The problem is we've cut taxes so much in the last 12 years for wealthy investors and corporations, and now we want to cut them more, you know, for corporations. Corporations, by the way, today pay only 12% of their profits in taxes. The historic average every year between 1989 and 2008 for corporations was 24%. They're paying half of what they were paying historically for two decades now, and Obama wants to cut them more. They're already sitting on $2 trillion corporate America, cash hoard, and refusing to invest it in America, and we want to give them more tax cuts?
And that's the deal.
I mean, the problem's a tax problem. It's not a spending problem.
Oh, it is, Jack. And, of course, there are so many other responsible policies that could really set the country on a correct course. I'm all in favor of a speculative Tobin tax. I'm in favor of downsizing the military, not just a little bit. America spends as much or more on militarism, including homeland, including all of the budget items relating to the military. They include veterans benefits. They include interest on the national debt. You've got
$1 trillion a year.
Oh, I mean, it the official budget is $600 odd billion.
No, it's $1 trillion. Yeah.
Well, but the real budget, I think, is at least $1.5 trillion, and there are black intelligence budgets that don't get published. There are 16 U.S. intelligence agencies. CIA and NSA are just two of them. But you got the military budgets. Yeah, the Army has its intelligence. The Air Force, the Navy, maybe the Coast Guard has it. But 16 U.S. intelligence budgets. I don't think a single one of them publishes their budgets. I remember writing a number of years ago where a former CIA official involved in CIA budgeting came out publicly and talked about the number, and it was something like $50 billion maybe 5 years ago. How accurate that is, I don't know. But George Bush greatly increased the budget for the CIA. CIA could spend $100 billion a year. NSA, how many billions or tens of billions does NSA spend? And all the other spying that goes on. You've got the Pentagon's black budgets. Well, you know, they're fighting the war, and they need a supplemental add-on, so they add on so many billions of dollars multiple times a year if they need it. I mean, we're talking about ungodly amounts of money spent on things that there's no need for. And I stress all the time in many articles, Jack, that America has not had an enemy since Japan surrendered in August of 1945, except the ones it invents to fight permanent wars. There is not a single year that goes by without America being at war. Now, in multiple venues abroad, waging a war on many of its own people at home, waging proxy wars, and Obama more than doubled down George Bush. He probably tripled down George Bush. Obama is the most belligerent president in America's history. He's got plans for more wars. Imagine all the money spent on this stuff, Jack. Imagine if it were used for productive economic growth. We would have the greatest boom in world history.
Well, I wrote a piece on my blog called The Eight Real Causes of Deficits and Debts, and this is appropriate to what you're saying. The first real cause of the run-up in the debt over the last decade, we went from $5.5 trillion to $16 trillion. And the first real cause was the Bush tax cut, which have cost us $3.4 trillion so far, 80% of which go to the wealthiest investors and households. But the second largest is defense spending. The consumer price index over the last decade rose at about 2% per year. However, defense spending, starting with George Bush, has risen 8.2% per year compounded. If you only had defense spending rise at the 2% CPI rate for the rest of us, right, you would have saved $2.1 trillion. So $2.1 trillion is just inflation and increase in defense spending over the last decade. $2.1 trillion. 3.4 tax cuts. 2.1. Well, there's almost $6 trillion just in Bush tax cuts and defense spending. $6 trillion of the $10 trillion addition added to deficits in the debt over the last 12 years. The rest is pretty much runaway health care costs that have pumped up government Medicare, Medicaid spending, and Part D of the prescription drug plan, Part D of Medicare, right, in which Bush and Democrats passed the prescription drug bill, which is really just a pharmaceutical subsidy bill, allows the pharmaceuticals to charge whatever they want for whatever drugs. And they raise no taxes to pay for it, so it's all out of deficit spending. Those are the three biggies, and then you throw in a weak recovery, which means tax revenues don't really recover, and interest on the debt, and there you are. There in the bailouts, of course, $1.5 trillion fiscal bailouts. There's your $10 trillion. If you notice, I said nothing about Social Security. I said nothing about increase in benefits for education and so forth. It's all taxes and defense spending and runaway health care costs. That's what it is. That's the deficits and the debt. But are they focusing on that? No. Obama, during the election campaign, made it clear that this supposed sequestered $500 billion in defense cuts that were supposed to come into effect here in January. And this is a quote from him in one of the debates, said, well, that was Congress's proposal, not mine. That was a signal that he's not going to let $500 billion in defense cuts occur. And, in fact, if you look at the Congressional Budget Office proposals reflecting his budget, what was supposed to be the cut as part of the trillion-dollar deal, what was supposed to be the cut in defense spending? $24 billion this year. That's all. $24 billion. They can get that by, moving the money around, accounting gimmicks and so forth, and so they're not cutting defense, In fact, they're going to up defense because it's pretty clear now U.S. foreign policy is reorienting to the Western Pacific, the supposed China threat. And you're going to see big expenditures for the Navy and the Air Force. The Middle East was the Army's war. Well, now, it's Navy and Air Force. We go from one war to the next in order to keep the defense expenditures going.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is a topic that I write about so often, Jack. I mean, literally, America has a permanent war policy. I wrote two major articles on it. It goes back a little ways now. And literally, the most astonishing fact, Jack, I ever ran across, and I've got it all documented in a book, this chapter and verse on U.S. history, you can go back to 1776, and really before 1776, and there is not one single year in U.S. history that America has not been at war, either abroad and or at home, not a single year of peace, and for certain there is not another nation in world history that in its entire history has a record like that. I mean, even the most belligerent countries of all time, at some points in time, they were not at war. The only permanent war I know about is in fiction, and that's Orwell's 1984. But America literally follows a 1984 Orwellian policy. It needs to have enemies. It needs to hype fear. It needs to get people to go along with what they should oppose. And they create fictitious enemies. They create them abroad. They wage hot wars. They wage financial wars. They wage propaganda wars. And this thing goes on without end. And this is what our money is used, what it's spent on, Jack. And ordinary people needs get sidetracked, they get trashed, they get eroded, and they're on the way to being eliminated, because for me, the fiscal cliff, Jack, is subterfuge for destroying America's social contract, and I refer to it as death by a thousand cuts. A decade or two from now, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, public pensions, food stamps, they either won't exist, or from their present form to then, they'll be unrecognizable. And if you turn any of this stuff over to Wall Street sharks, privatizing them, they will strip mine them of value, and they'll screw ordinary people, just the way when IRAs replaced public pensions, it wasn't the same for savers. Social Security is a marvelous program. I think we pretty much agree on that, Jack. No monkeying around with it. You know, I mean, they steal from the Social Security Trust Fund. But Social Security, I'm 78 years old. It was there for me when I retired. Nobody monkeyed with it. Nobody speculated with the money. Nobody came to me at age 65 and said, oh, we're sorry, we tried to make more than we said we would, and we lost it all. That didn't happen. And my Social Security check comes direct deposit every month without fail. It shows up all the time, but it sure won't for young people today when they get to where I am. Let's take a break. We'll come back. Jack, in the second half, this is the time of year you make your next year's predictions. Let's talk about that when we come back.
PRN.FM. PRN.FM. The number one station for progressive minds. Progressive minds.
We are the music makers, and we are the dreamers of the dreams.
My name is Rachel Trachtenberg.
And I'm Julia Cumming.
Our show, Pure Imagination, is on every Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. Join us each week for the latest in arts, music, politics, through the perspective of conscious teens. If you miss a show, you can always check out our archives at PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hi, I'm Sandy Leon Best, host of Political Analysis. Welcome to the 21st century, where the corporate propaganda machine works 24-7 to manufacture your reality. Every Tuesday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, Political Analysis challenges the corporate narrative with independent news, analysis, and passionate conversations on the most critical issues of our time. Don't let the corporate echo machine become your truth. Tune in live to Political Analysis or visit the archives at prn.fm. If you like the show, rate us in iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
at last, an alternative to the ravings of right-wing radio. The Bert Cohen Show digs down to give you the hidden truths behind the stories that affect us all. I'm Bert Cohen, and I make full use of over 40 years of experience as an anti-war activist, political columnist, and 7 terms as state senator in conservative New Hampshire to uncover the real stories behind today's headlines. Thursdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time at PRN.FM. If you miss a show, you can check it out on the archives. And if you like the show, rate us on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Welcome back. I'm with Jack Rasmus, talking about the fiscal cliff. I want to talk a little bit about what Jack sees coming in 2013. You never can tell, no matter how dark the clouds are, no matter how ominous the future looks. The market manipulators have a way of keeping the ball suspended, rolling, the dirty game going. You know the way it works. We had crisis break in fall of 2007. 2008 was a grim year. Well, 2009 was a recovery for the bankers and the big corporations. Certainly was no recovery for ordinary people. Mainstream America, you know, working class people, working households, the great majority of people in the country, not exactly the 99%, but the great majority, 80-90% of people, there's a main street depression going on. It's been going on all these years. Doesn't look to me like it's getting any better. It looks like it's getting worse. It's very protracted, but you cannot tell the health of the economy by looking at the stock market, by looking at GDP. Stock market, all the markets are manipulated. So you know the big boys take it up, they take it down, they move it up and down continually, you know, over short time frames, and they make money on the upside, on the downside. They make money manipulating the bond market, the currency markets, the commodity markets. Gold ought to be double the price it is now, but the manipulators hold the price down, probably same for silver too, maybe 3 or 4 times the price it is now. Sooner or later, if they keep playing these dirty currency games, it'll get there. There are some interesting predictions about how those things will go, but it's the only true value. But ordinary people are really suffering, and the fiscal cliff, of course, the debate, as it will be resolved at some point, sometime next year, finalized that is, ordinary people are going to be hit very, very hard. The most disadvantaged people in the country, already suffering, already going through a mainstream depression, instead of getting help, they're going to be hit harder. So it'll be a very, very lump of coalish 2013 for them. Who knows what's coming after that? I mean, it could just keep getting worse and worse and worse. And if my prediction, Jack, of death by 1,000 cuts for America's social contract comes true, I shudder to think what America will look like in a decade or 2 decades. I once described it as Guatemala, turning America into Guatemala in the worst sense of the word. You could call it third worldizing America, police state laws on the books to target non-believers, anybody who doesn't like the idea of what's been done to them. Well, you know, you'll tell it to the riot cops or whoever else would come after you. And this is the condition of the country. Again, it's tough to predict what will happen in the next 12 months, Jack, but let you give it a crack.
Well, you know, I make these predictions every year in an extended feature-length article in Z Magazine. My January Z Magazine, however, is dedicated to the fiscal cliff, the three faces of the fiscal cliff, it's called. I will be putting that up on my website, Kiklis Production, for folks to read as well. It's a little bit more difficult to make predictions this year. You can read my predictions of last year and prior by going to that article that I will put up on Fiscal Cliff and on a subsequent article that I will be writing and probably not appearing until the February issue of Z Magazine on new predictions. I think a lot of where the economy is going to go is dependent on two things. One is, what is the final structure of this so-called fiscal cliff, i.e., a.k.a. austerity American style? It will be a drag on the economy no matter what form it takes. And what happens to the consumer, which is 70% of the economy. I'll talk about that shortly. And most importantly this year, what happens in the rest of the global economy and how that affects the U.S.? I think, in general, we're going to continue the bump along the bottom, which means an average growth rate of less than 2%, maybe around 1%. No real recovery in the U.S. And as I've been predicting for over a year, if we have another recurrence of a global crisis, particularly in Europe, now maybe in Japan, then that will trip us into a double-dip recession sometime in 2013. So the double-dip recession is based upon what does the fiscal cliff solution, austerity solution, look like, how severe is it, and what happens elsewhere in the world. So it's a little harder to forecast, but I, at best, we will bump along the bottom. If you look at the third quarter GDP last year, and I agree with you, GDP is not the best indicator, but if you look at that, we had a 3% growth rate. Well, that doesn't sound too bad, except that most of it was because of the government concentrating all of its defense spending and government spending into the third quarter right before the election, third quarter being July, September, the biggest increase in 2.5 years in government spending all in one quarter. That boosted artificially that 3%. And we had a lot of consumer spending based upon debt, on borrowing, and auto companies really giving big discounts, price discounts, and inventory growth by business. Those factors are not there in the fourth quarter, and already we're seeing retail sales and other problems emerging in the fourth quarter, and I think we'll probably get about 1.5%. Part of that will be falsely stimulated by business spending trying to take advantage of tax cuts before they might expire. Business has been doing that. So going into 2013, I think we're going to see at best 1 to 1.5%, which is a very, very sluggish, bumping along the bottom growth rate. Consumers are already pulling in their horns. Consumption for the bottom 90% households has been driven by credit and debt, which is not sustainable. The wealthiest 10%, of course, are spending based upon stock market gains, which have been quite good over the past year. Housing, they claim there's a big recovery in housing. I don't believe so. It's a minor recovery, and it's going to bounce along the bottom as well. And it's mostly driven by apartment building and by speculators buying up foreclosures and selling them and so forth. Where we really see weakness is in manufacturing, because the global economy is slowing down and trade and exports are slowing down, and currency crises will have the same effect. Manufacturing won't do well. It's already clear. There will be another crisis in Europe. What I call the Draghi effect, Draghi is the head of the central bank, European Central Bank, who's been pumping up or preventing, I should say, the further collapse, putting a floor under the collapse in Europe by simply talking up possibilities of a banking union and so forth. That's going to wear off in 2013. And watch for other difficult pressure points in Europe besides Greece, probably Portugal, and perhaps some others are going to be in trouble. And in all the European economies, including the big ones, France and Germany, are slowing down or in recession already. That will continue. Japan, new crisis point. Very volatile. We don't know what's going to happen there. The new president says he's going to pump up monetary and fiscal policy. We'll see what happens. But Japan is very worried now because of deflation. And that's been their problem for two decades. And that's a problem of these poor recoveries. You know, Ben Bernanke has pumped trillions of dollars into the economy trying to get the inflation rate up to 2% and can't do it. After trillions and trillions of dollars, it just shows you that this classical idea that economists adhere to, that money causes inflation, is just nonsense. If that were so, the trillions, tens of trillions of dollars should have produced, double, triple digit inflation, but it hasn't. The problem is still deflation. And when you have falling prices, it's a big problem because consumers hold off from spending, waiting for the prices to fall further. And businesses hold off from investing because they're unsure whether they can recover their costs if the prices fall further down the road. So you get a freezing up, a drag on both business spending and consumer spending when you have deflation. That's the real bugaboo. And very clearly in Japan, but it's also a problem here that's continuing to emerge as well as in Europe. Watch out for the bond markets. Can be a very, very big problem, particularly junk bonds, but they can stumble through with all the free money from the Fed for another year. China, I think, will have a moderate recovery because they're pumping money back in to the Chinese economy, the leadership there, so that will stabilize at maybe a 5-7% growth rate. So, in other words, it's going to be more of the same, unless and until you get a big austerity effect here in the U.S. and or the rest of the global economy trips into a deeper crisis. So at best, more of the same that we saw in the first 6 months of last year, because the last 6 months in the U.S. have been a false positive growth. The first 6 months of last year, by the way, was barely 1% economic growth. We could see that again. Barely 1% here in the next 6 months in the U.S. So more of the same, and as I've always predicted, we slip into a double dip if we have a renewed euro crisis, which is possible, and or if we have a deep fiscal cliff, austerity spending contraction here in the U.S.
Not a very
mouthful,
picture, Jack.
That's a mouthful, I know.
The good news is it's less than a disaster scenario, but it certainly is nothing that will bring cheer to people who have really been going through very bad times for a number of years now and are looking for some kind of a silver lining that may show up one of these days. It ain't going to show up next year.
No, there's no robust recovery coming, and, you know, the global capitalist, U.S. capitalist system will not crash, you know, in a big crash. It's more like a slow decline, a slow drag and a lack of real growth as more and more capital gets expended on speculative, non-job creating activities. That's the big problem I point out in Epic Recession, is that the money capital is shifting from real asset, real things, investing, to speculative forms of investing. In other words, investing in securities, financial securities, and global markets, liquid markets all around the world, derivatives and so forth. Even your big corporations, multinational corporations, now over a quarter of all their profits come from this speculative activity. And that's what's happening with capitalism. It's moving towards a speculative kind of form that dominates. You know, it always existed, but now it's beginning to dominate the system, and that translates into slow, real economic growth, and that means a lack of real job creation.
Jack, there are two terms for that. Either financializing the economy, are casino capitalism. It reflects speculation. And, of course, only the ones that speculate are the ones that gain or lose. It does nothing to grow the economy. You know, bankers can speculate and make many billions of dollars. They can pay out big salaries and bonuses. Ordinary people don't benefit from that. I don't know how America can ever be the way it was before, Jack, unless a way is found.
Oh, it won't. No, it won't. You know, if you call financialization, if you call it this speculative investing shift, which I call it, then, you know, it's a chronic condition. And, you know, it's not just bankers that we think of. It's not just J.P. Morgan and so forth. It's all the shadow banking system.
Oh, yeah.
In which there's more assets, investable assets now than in the formal banking system. The shift is increasingly in that direction. And that's why, you know, we have the problems that we have, these financial bubbles that appear. You know, as soon as the economy begins, quote, if it does, to recover a little bit, you're going to see more of these financial bubbles occurring. And the politicians can't bring these speculators to heel. You know, I mean, you see it in Europe, and the Europeans complain about it. Oh, these, private equity firms and so forth are speculating in Greek bond credit default swaps and making the situation worse. And of course they are, but they can't do anything about it, or they haven't done anything about it, because the political power of these financial institutions is still very, very great, and they can't run the risk of aggravating their financial benefactors. Politicians in Europe, for example. You know, the European situation is a banking crisis. It's not a sovereign debt crisis. That's only the surface appearance. All this talk about forming a banking union as necessary is really preparation for bailing out the banks once they have another crash over there, which is likely coming sometime in the next 5 years. And that's always been the problem. You know, the bankers have been behind the sovereign debt crisis from the very beginning, creating it, and now they want to be bailed out. The difference in Europe is they don't really have a Federal Reserve like we do that can print the money and bail everybody out by printing the money and by supervising and overlooking the banks like Bernanke did here. And they don't have a common fiscal union where you can bail out the worst states like we can, you know, with the one tax system that we have. So Europe is really at a big disadvantage, and I don't see them solving these fundamental structural problems, which means their crisis is going to get worse.
But they sure manipulated the system, Jack. I mean, Mario Draghi, the central banker of the ECB, I mean, they have their rules in place, but he sure has bent them and twisted them. And the German parliament, I mean, Germany, the economic juggernaut, maybe the most fiscally stable or responsible country on the continent. I mean, they're literally the power behind this, driving this to keep the euro system intact. The euro system was a failed system from day one, and one of these days it's going to collapse, who knows when, but Germany is either trying to keep it going or doing what it has to do to benefit itself, and the German parliamentarians go along with this, but Draghi breaks his own rules by twisting them. And but it's true. I mean, it's not like the Fed. America has a one size fits all system, and the euro system, 17 countries, which is a crazy system, Jack. It's a different topic altogether. But you got a non functional zombie country like Greece, coupled with an economic juggernaut like Germany. I mean, it's absolutely crazy. It's like putting me back out on the basketball court in my day with Wilt Chamberlain. I mean, that would be crazy. I mean, he would just step on me and it would be all over.
It wasn't so crazy for the Germans. The Germans have profited, and the French, tremendously from the euro. You see, the euro, the creation of the euro, allowed the Germans and Northern Europeans, meaning bankers and investors from Northern Europe, to lend a tremendous amount of money to the southern and periphery, a lot of it going into real estate, stimulating real estate, and then they're loaning to the government to build infrastructure, and the governments, of course, pass some of these loans from the north on to the rest of their population, because you can't give it all to the real estate folks, and Germany particular, and the banks in Germany, when we say Germany, we mean the northern banks, Deutsche Bank, Commerzbank, so forth, pumping all this money into the periphery and making huge amounts off of it. Because as long as you pump this money into the periphery and you have, as we did 10 years ago when the euro was first formed, a pretty good economic growth in Europe, it meant the periphery was buying all these German exports. You know, so German companies were making money over fists, loaning it to the periphery. The periphery would spend it on German imports, and the money would come right back to Germany. And now that you got a crisis, the euro is falling, which is great for Germany. They love the euro to fall. And they love the crisis that drives the euro down because Germany exports to the rest of the world. So Germany causes, not just Germany, northern banks, cause this problem in the eurozone and then profit greatly as a result of this profit in the eurozone.
And Jack, one of the situations now is that in crisis conditions in the PIGS countries, especially Greece, Spain, Portugal, Ireland, I guess it's come back a little bit, Italy, you get these countries in need of borrowing large amounts, you get them dead and trapped, you get them selling off their crown jewel assets and resources, and if countries like Germany don't profit by selling exports, then the financial interests, the banks and the big financial interests, profit by strip mining these countries of their assets and resources at fire sale prices. So they keep winning.
Yeah, well, there's the sovereign debt crisis that we just described on the surface, loaning money to governments. But now with the, you know, there's a negative. It's not all beneficial to the northern bankers. The negative is their affiliates and southern banks get in trouble. So then they got to bail out their banks, and the, you know, Bankia in Spain and UniCredit in Italy and so forth. They got to bail them out. So now you got a banking crisis when this thing drags on. So how are they going to bail out the banks? Well, they've been giving money to the sovereign governments in the periphery to bail out the banks, but the sovereign governments have a deficit problem of their own, and they haven't really shifted all of that money to bail out the banks. So now you got to have a direct conduit to bail out the banks in the periphery, because if you don't, it'll drag down the banks in the core, which is happening. So that's why you need a true central bank, a banking union, so that the ECB can directly bail out banks in the periphery and not have to give more money to the governments that don't always shift the money to bail out the banks, you see. That's what it's all about.
But it's a very, very destructive system, Jack. And again, this thing goes on year after year. There's no resolution. The best they can hope for is barely keeping their heads above water. They can dip in and out of recessions. Germany has had at least one negative quarter. Britain has had some negative quarters. France looks to be in trouble. Of course, Greece is in big trouble. Spain is in big trouble. Italy is not in the best shape. Portugal is not in the best shape. Ireland isn't in such great shape. I mean, this is a disease that nothing is being done to cure it. You just keep the ball rolling. You keep the system going, keep it from drowning, but you don't solve the problems.
Well, that's what I described in the very beginning. The fundamental strategy is let's wait out the crisis. Let's make sure our banks, I'm talking from a capitalist standpoint, our banks, our investors, are made whole, are prevented from collapsing. Let's bail them out, and let's just tough out the rest and hope that the economy will self-generate. And that's what's going on in Europe as well as the United States. In other words, put a floor under the collapse of the financial institutions and hope that the rest of the economy will recover. And as long as we have deficits, well, let's squeeze the people a little bit here and there, you know, continually, while we're waiting out this difficult period and waiting for everything to recover. That's the fundamental strategy of austerity, you see. Austerity for them, in other words, for the rest of us, we're them, and us meaning, you know, bankers and investors and the wealthy, put a floor on and protect our income, and we'll let the rest of the people pay for the crisis and hope the crisis will end in 3 or 4 years. But it doesn't end. If Japan's the example, you keep bouncing along the bottom for a very long time, meaning you got to continually squeeze the people a little bit more, a little bit more. In Europe, they got to squeeze a lot because they don't have a true central monetary fiscal system. They got to squeeze more than they squeeze in the United States because the U.S. has a true central bank. Okay, that's the difference why austerity here has not yet been as severe as austerity in Europe.
Well, it's a very dismal system, Jack, and I must say I'm old enough to remember the country I grew up in the 1940s.
By the way, let me just tell your listeners, I will be talking on my radio show on Progressive Network on predictions for the coming year.
That will be
next Wednesday at on PRN.
Oh, marvelous. What time are you on, Jack?
2 p.m. Eastern Time.
Oh, you got to tune in. Alternative Visions. Jack, of course, is a regular on this program. He certainly tells it the way people need to know in terms of economic and financial issues. Jack tells it straight. No. Jack, you've done it on this program month after month. It's very important information, and we really keep listeners up to date on what's going on, what they can expect. The point I was making was, it's not the country that I grew up in the 1940s and 1950s. America was industrialized back in those days. The country wasn't yet financialized. There was always speculation and financial mumbo-jumbo, hocus-pocus going on, but it was an industrial country. I worked in industrial America for a number of years. I worked for a steel company as a marketing analyst in Pittsburgh. Steel company is a shell of what it used to be. Pittsburgh isn't the city that I spent a number of years in. A home city, Boston, wasn't a big industrial town. But that's all changed. Chicago has changed, my Chicago, from the years from the time I got here in the 60s to the city it is today. America is a different country today. It's not the country that gives opportunity to young people. It's why I worry about them. But ordinary people can change things, hopefully, if they try hard enough for a long enough period of time. Jack, my feeling is if we don't try, if we don't do it on our own, it'll never happen. But I've got to sign off. The hour is up. Join us again tomorrow. We'll be back at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Saturdays, of course, the same time. Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. We'll always cover the major issues, economic, war and peace, the rest of them. Important guests like Jack will tell it straight. We'll tell it the way you need to hear it. Join us then. Make it a regular habit. Thank you.